The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel. The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey everybody, welcome back. I'm so glad you're here. I hope you're all doing well, and I am so deeply glad we're heading into the holiday season because, I don't know, this week I have this deep urge to be kind to people. And it's weird to feel like you need an excuse or a holiday to give you some sort of emotional cover to do it, but I'll take it. I feel like the subtext of this entire show is about reaching out with your hand and your heart to other people, and finding out what connects us and getting excited about that. Which for me, for a guy who's felt very much alone and isolated for a lot of his life, has really been the one thing I've always wanted to do. And this podcast has given that to me in so many ways that I never could have imagined. And that has to do with all of you. I'm reaching out and you're reaching back. I don't know the secret of life, but I feel like that's gotta be close. So let's all kind of huddle close together for the end of the year. What do you say? Okay, there's a scene in the upcoming episode where I go to a friend, a really good friend of mine, for dating advice. And the advice I get is a little problematic. Couple things about that. This is exactly the kind of advice guys give other guys, and not just in 1983. And within this advice, there's a lot of assumptions about how guys think they need to act in sexual situations. And those assumptions can be pretty off base. And I gotta be honest, until it was flagged for me by people on my team, I didn't even notice it because it was such a part of growing up male in America in the 80s. Maybe it still is. I mean, I can tell you one thing. A lot of the kids I know now, my kids' friends, the conversation you hear is not the sort of conversation they would ever have. And definitely not in a bar at age 16. So maybe there's progress. Anyway, last thing, if you ever check out the show notes, I don't know, do you guys go to the website? Do you look at the show notes? I put show notes on every episode about how to get books and all that stuff. Maybe you never go there. If you've never done it, go this time. Okay, for this episode, there's a lot of pictures of books, a lot of links to get books, but most important, you will see the most dope-ass picture of a 1981 two-tone, two-door, tan Chevy Citation. Oh my God, do I love this car. This was my dad's car. And if this doesn't take you back to the early 80s, nothing will. All right, so buckle up. Here we go. Voices of the Dead by Susie Smith. Susie Smith's Voices of the Dead, Signet Books, New American Library, 1977, was not the first book ever written about electronic voice phenomenon, nor was it the second, third, fifth, or seventh. I don't know where it places on the chronological list, but it was my first, and so for me, it will always be the best. And in 1977, when EVP was still only known to a small handful of practitioners, it provided a reader with everything they needed to start communicating with the dead. All that was required was a tape recorder, fresh batteries, and some spare time. I had all three when I found Susie Smith's book in December of 1982. I bought it with my Christmas money, along with a bunch of other books, at the Alhambra Bookstore on Main Street in Alhambra. I was a junior in high school. I'd just gotten my driver's license. The world was finally beginning to open up, and I was ready. I remember reading this book on New Year's Eve, 1982, and then on New Year's Day, 1983, and feeling like I'd discovered some kind of magic volume. By then, I'd read tons of books about ghosts and seances and haunted British castles. But according to this book, you didn't have to go anywhere to find a ghost. The spirits were around you all the time. All you had to do was give them a microphone and let them rip. This was ghost hunting made easy. It was thrilling and horrifying. That thing I'd been fantasizing about for years, personal proof, was now within my grasp. The only question was I brave enough to reach out there and grab it? I was 16, and as you might guess, talking to the dead wasn't the only thing I fantasized about. Girls were on my mind day and night. Another thing that seemed within my grasp, tantalizingly close, literally right there, but somehow, due to my own lack of nerve, still unattainable. Yeah, I know, ha-ha, but please try to remember high school for a minute. I'd been actively trying to lose my virginity since freshman year. Kids of today, all I can tell you is, it was a different time. If you graduated high school a virgin, why did you even go? What did you really learn? Deep down, I knew that if I somehow found a girl who liked me enough to sleep with me, it would be in the form of a girlfriend, and it would fill the emotional void at the center of my soul. I would finally feel welcomed and loved by a woman in a way that would not make me feel scared and at risk and emotionally enslaved. Or at least, that was the plan. As 1983 got rolling, I became aware of another urge inside me, beyond recording spirit voices and somehow getting laid. It had to do with being a writer. But what that meant, or how to accomplish it, was foggy at best. I was reading a lot of Stephen King and Michael Crichton and Harlan Ellison. I thought maybe I should be writing short stories, but I just didn't know how. Writing a novel seemed way beyond me, and to be honest, still does. But there was an anxious feeling buzzing inside of me all the time, like a motor revving. I wanted to hit the gas, but I didn't know where I was going. And I wasn't the kind of kid who just did random shit. No partying, no drinking, no smoking, no shoplifting or joyriding or drug taking. No relaxing. I was locked down and always in control. I wore my seatbelt. I needed a plan. Weirdly, communicating with the dead seemed the easiest. I could do it alone in my room. I was very good at doing things alone in my room. And I had a tape recorder. Are you ready for this? I had a tape recorder so I could listen to my cassette tapes while I drove around town in my dad's 1981 tan two-tone, two-door Chevy Citation hatchback because all it had was a radio. I remember sitting in my bedroom and taking the cellophane off a TDK cassette tape and putting it into the recorder late on a Sunday night and getting no further. My plan was to ask a very simple question. Is anyone there? I wanted an answer, but the idea of actually getting an answer was absolutely terrifying. Susie Smith's book tells the story I'm sure you've all heard 100 times. With all the same names and faces carved into stone on the Mount Rushmore of EVP. Attila von Zalle, Friedrich Jurgensen, and of course, Konstantin Rodova. But for me, way back then, this was all brand new, reality-shattering information. Some dude named Friedrich Jurgensen was in the orchards outside his house recording bird calls, and when he played them back, he heard the voice of his dead mother calling his name, Fritzi. A Latvian psychologist and philosopher named Konstantin Rodova became aware of Jurgensen's work in this area and tried to replicate his results, and just like that, wham, he started getting voices. What's great about Smith's book is that she wasn't first out of the gate, so she's able to provide a peppy run-through of the history of EVP through 1977, and she doesn't spend a ton of time belaboring every step of the process. Susie Smith was a publishing phenomenon in the 1960s and 70s, sort of a paranormal Irma Bombeck. Look it up. She wrote more than 30 books, all of them about supernatural topics, and often with titles that use the suffix for the millions, like ESP for the millions, haunted houses for the millions, reincarnation for the millions, out-of-body experiences for the millions. She was writing for a wide general audience, and her books acted as primers, covering a subject broadly, with many tantalizing stories, but leaving it up to the reader to then dive into more specialized works if they wanted to. But she wasn't just a writer. She had psychic experiences of her own, as well as a spiritual transformation as a born-again Christian, subjects she covered in two searingly personal autobiographies, Confessions of a Psychic, 1971, and Conversion of a Psychic, 1978. Her style is inviting, confidential, and captivating. She's your fun aunt who decorates the house for Halloween all year long and doesn't mind talking about spooky stuff at the dinner table, no matter how many dirty looks your mom gives her. Voices of the Dead is a slim, great-smelling paperback. It's only 143 pages long, but it does everything it needs to do, and more. Right away, Smith draws a distinction between Jurgensen and Rodova's practical approach to the phenomenon. Jurgensen largely dismissed any voices too faint or distorted to be clearly understood on first listen. He felt that only strong, clear voices should be considered, so there would be no need for interpretation. The message would be obvious to anyone and everyone who listened. Rodova, on the other hand, classified his voices as A, B, or C. A voices were loud and clear, B voices less so, and C voices were sometimes only apparent to Rodova himself. Jurgensen felt that struggling to interpret voices left too much to the listener's imagination. Rodova was in it for quantity, not class A quality. And by the time he died in 1974 at the age of 65, he claimed to have recorded more than 100,000 voices. I'll be honest. I own 4 first American editions of Rodova's breakthrough book, Breakthrough, An Amazing Experiment in Electronic Communication with the Dead. In fact, 2 of them are signed by Rodova himself. I also own the first German edition entitled Und Hörbares wird Hörbar, The Inaudible Becomes Audible. But I've never read a word of any of them. By the time I learned about the book's existence, I'd already learned everything I needed to know about doing EVP from Susie Smith. In fact, there's a handy chapter in Voices of the Dead entitled Recording Instructions. It covers equipment, procedure, various alternative techniques, troubleshooting, and playback, and it's only 8 pages long. See, guys, it's simple. Anyone can do it. Everything you want is right there at your fingertips. So what are you waiting for? Tuesday, February 22nd, 1983. I was in Frau Ulla's third period German with Gary Takeuchi and Tim Pallant. We were goofing around before class, talking about what we were going to do that night. Tim said he was going to watch Three's Company. And me, being me, said something like, "Oh, you don't have to watch it. I'll tell you what's going to happen. Jack's going to come in and he'll like overhear Chrissy on the phone talking to someone and somehow think that she's pregnant. So he'll tell Janet and they'll freak out, but it'll turn out that what Chrissy's really expecting is an old college roommate who's visiting from out of town." Gary and Tim were cracking up, so I started pushing it. I kept going. And the old friend is someone Jack had a crush on, and so Chrissy wants it to be a surprise for Jack, so she's being secretive. And everyone's misinterpreting why she's being secretive. And then she'll say something to Janet about how, there's a surprise and it's Jack's. And now Janet's going to think that Jack is the one that got Chrissy pregnant and he doesn't know it yet. Now, Gary and Tim aren't laughing anymore. They're just kind of looking at me like, is it a rerun? Did he already see it? But as I'm saying all this, a thought is forming in my mind and I speak the thought out loud. I could write an episode of Three's Company. I was still kind of joking, dunking on how predictable Three's Company is. But I'd seen enough episodes to know the characters and the kinds of plots they did and the rhythm of the show. Something about that really tickled me. What if I did? What if I just wrote a Three's Company episode? Almost as like a parody or a gag. Could I make it seem exactly like an actual episode? The very idea seemed totally bonkers, but also weirdly thrilling. Here's what you need to understand. TV writing was not a thing in 1983, and certainly not among Alhambra High School students. The idea that I would just sit down, alone in my room, and write an episode of an existing TV show seemed so goofy and delightful and fun and magical and empowering that I couldn't stop thinking about it. What would I even do with it once I'd written it? For the rest of the day, I had a vague plan to watch Three's Company at 9 o'clock on ABC and really see if it was something I thought I could do. As it turns out, I never did watch Three's Company that night because at 8, I watched The A-Team and the course of my life changed forever. It was an episode called Black Day at Bad Rock. And here I reach a difficult crossroads. I want to describe the episode in detail and express to you how it struck me as the most original, exciting, unexpected, and engrossing hour of television I'd ever seen. But at the same time, I don't want to sound like a fucking moron. And yet, I was 16, and I felt all those things, and if you're going to sit back and smirk at my feelings of pure and wide-eyed discovery, then I'm going to suggest to you that you have forgotten what it is to be young and in love. By the time 9 o'clock rolled around, I had totally forgotten about my date with Jack and Chrissy and Janet. I only had eyes for Hannibal, and Face, and Murdoch, and B.A. And now I knew what I was going to do. I was going to write an episode of The A-Team, and I knew what I was going to do with it. I was going to get it into the hands of the show's creator, Stephen J. Cannell. He was going to buy it. Then he was going to hire me onto the show to write more episodes. Then I would drop out of high school, buy a car, get an apartment in the Los Feliz Manor on Los Feliz Boulevard, and then I was going to get a girlfriend. Because only then would I have earned it. Now I had a plan. I drove out to the Puente Hills Mall and went straight to the B. Dalton Pickwick bookstore. I didn't even pause at the occult New Age section. I went straight to reference books and scanned the spines until I found the only one that might help me. J. Michael Straczynski's Complete Book of Scriptwriting. There was one copy. And at the time, as far as I know, it was the only book that existed that had anything to do with writing for television. It described in detail exactly how slug lines worked, the purpose and use of action lines, and how dialogue was to appear on the page. Now at least my script would look professional, which I figured put me ahead of most people trying to write an A-team script who were probably using crayons. My favorite section was in the back of the book, a complete listing of all literary agencies in Hollywood, over 100 places where I could send my script once I wrote it and try to get an agent to represent me. My plan was coming together. Meanwhile, I've been hanging out with Michelle Goodwin a lot. I'd known Michelle since my first day of high school, and we were friends. But I felt like that might be changing, or could change if I wanted it to and did something about it. And I really liked her, and she didn't scare me. And we knew each other, and I trusted her. And she was really cute, and maybe the smartest girl in the whole school. And she was funny, and she thought I was funny. A couple of months earlier, I had promised to take her out for her birthday, but when the week rolled around, I was busy doing a play at the Broadway Playhouse in San Gabriel. So our plans got put off indefinitely. But this date was sort of hovering out there. When March arrived, our high school's prom bids went on sale, and suddenly I thought, why not make a big swing? Forget taking her out for her birthday. Why not ask her out to the prom? Here's exactly how I asked her. Michelle, in honor of National Women in History Week, would you go to the prom with me? She closed her eyes and kind of leaned her head back, just for a second or two, maybe three. Then she tilted her head forward, opened her eyes, looked at me, and said, yes. I found out later what happened in those 3 seconds. She'd been expecting, even hoping, for Tom Sines to ask her to the prom. But I had surprised her by asking her first. So she only had 3 seconds to decide whether to hold out for Tom or just say yes to me right now. That yes set into motion 19 years of on-again, off-again dating, a marriage, 2 children, and eventually a divorce. So eat that, Tom Sines. Michelle said, you know, you still owe me a dinner for my birthday. Oh. Oh, my fucking God. I ask her out on one date, and it turns into 2 dates? Richie, I don't know what you're putting out there, but you better make sure to use this power for good and not evil, okay? That night, alone in my room, I had a lot to think about. When I was done thinking about my upcoming date, I considered the 2 books sitting on my desk. The Complete Book of Scriptwriting and Voices of the Dead. The scriptwriting book dealt mostly in the formal details of composing a script and then selling it. It wasn't really about writing. But that was fine. All I needed to know to write a script for the A-team was the A-team. I'd already started making notes, and more important, I was thinking about it all the time, like a song you can't get out of your head. No matter what I was doing throughout the day, in the background, my brain was whirring away with thoughts about fun scenes, stunts, and cool lines. I can honestly say I never agonized over any of it. For this very first script, it was all pure joy. I only wrote what I thought was cool. I never had writer's block. I never spiraled into self-loathing. I never had to force myself to sit down and do the work. I worked on the script after I finished my homework. Riding the A-team was my dessert. Lining up a date with Michelle had also been easier than I thought. So, writing was happening, and girls were happening. So why was that tape recorder still sitting on my desk untouched? All I had to do was press a button. But so far I hadn't. How strange. The hardest things were coming easy, but the easy thing? Well, that was just going to have to wait. So, I'm about to go on my very first official date, and I need to know what to do. For advice, I go to my friend, Tim Doyle. Tim's older. I'm 16, he's 23. He's kind of the leader of our group, me, Larry, and Herb. We meet at Panchito's, right across the street from the Broadway Playhouse, the little theater behind the San Gabriel Mission Playhouse that he basically runs. We meet in the bar, like we're grown-ups, and this is grown-up talk. I ask him what to do on a first date. He tells me I have to be confident and aggressive and assertive. Okay, one out of three isn't bad. I feel confident, but assertive and aggressive, I don't know. It's Thursday, March 24th. I'm taking Michelle out tomorrow night, Friday the 25th. Tim asks me what my plan is, and I have a plan. Dinner at Stella's place in Pasadena. Then we drive all the way out to Westwood to see The King of Comedy, my all-time favorite movie ever since I saw it last weekend. Tim provisionally approves of all this, but he insists that at the end of the date, I have to kiss her. I have to. No way around it. But how do I ease into it, I ask. He tells me, you don't ease into it. You have to hit it head on. You have to declare yourself. No confusion, no room for misinterpretation. In EVP talk, this has to be a Class A voice. You have to say something like, I really want to kiss you. Or, before you go, there's something I've been wanting to do all night. Then you lean in and close your eyes and open your mouth. This sounds terrifying. What if she doesn't want to kiss me? Tim tells me not to worry. It always works. That's why you have to say what you're going to do, he tells me. Once you do, it'll be too awkward for her to refuse, he says. This sounds reasonable. My fear eases off a little. I can do this. Then I tell him about the presents. His face goes blank. What presents, he asks. Well, this is kind of a birthday date. I've bought her presents. I've wrapped them. I'm going to hide them in the car and give them to her once we get back to her house at the end of the night. I bought her a book of Doonesbury comic strips and a Sandra Boynton mug with cats holding balloons and a Beatles mixtape that Larry helped me make because she loves the Beatles, but I'm basically agnostic. Tim just stares at me. This is not what he expected to hear. I'm sure he's going to mock me, and maybe he should. Maybe I'm hopeless. But finally, he just shakes his head and says, Rich, after all that, she might just sleep with you. Bring a condom. I wear a suit. I'm just going to put that out there. I wear a goddamn suit. It's the suit I wore to my 8th grade graduation 3 years ago, and it still sort of fits. But it isn't lined, and it's super scratchy, and the shirt is stiff, so I wear a pair of my thinnest, softest pajamas underneath. I'm packed in pretty tight, and I'm feeling good. Just before I leave, I decide to ride my wave of confidence a little further. Without thinking about it too much, I press play and record on my tape recorder, and I lean in, and instead of asking, is anyone there? I ask, what's going to happen? I leave it running, step into the hall, close the door behind me, and head off into the night. Well, actually the late afternoon. It's still full daylight when I pick her up at 5 o'clock. She's wearing a dark blue denim half skirt above the knee and a green Angora sweater and dangly gold earrings and pantyhose. Just before we leave her house, her mother rushes up and hands her a $20 bill and says, just in case you end up in San Francisco or something. Neither one of us understands what she could possibly mean, but to me it's a thrilling concept. Could we end up in San Francisco? Is tonight really that full of surprise and possibility? We go out to dinner at Stella's place. We talk the whole time. There's never an awkward moment. We drive out to Westwood, 30 minutes. We see an 8 p.m. showing of The King of Comedy. I so identify with Rupert Pupkin. I love it even more the second time. But on the drive home, I'm in this dreamy place. I'm driving her home. I'm in the new world. I'm on a date. I'm like a grown-up. I've seen this a million times on TV, but I've never actually done it. We get to her house, and I'm so scared and so excited. It's exactly the feeling I have before going on stage. I'm afraid, but I'm excited because this might give me the love and acceptance I want so much. We park in front of her house. And then I do this move. I look her right in the eyes and I say, before you go inside, there's something I want to give you. And I lean right over toward her. And then I open the glove compartment and bring out her first present. She bursts out laughing. She opens the mug, and then the Doonesbury book, and finally the Beatles mixtape. There's nothing left to open, and we're just sort of sitting there. My heart is beating so hard, I feel like my head's gonna explode. I feel like I'm about to jump out of an airplane. I say, oh, right, there's one more thing. And then I lean over and kiss her. And she kisses me back. And that kiss goes on for a while, longer than any kiss I've ever kissed. We lean back, take a breath. A part of me thinks, if she wants out, now's when she'll stop me. I know I don't want to stop, so I move right back in. I kiss her again. And now we're making out. I don't know how, but I'm doing it anyway. And we make out for a long, long time. Remember making out? Remember just kissing someone for the longest time? It's an hour before I even think of putting my hand inside her sweater. But then, very slowly, I do. I move my hand under the soft green angora and begin searching for the back of her bra strap. After a moment, she whispers, "The clasp is in the front." She is telling me how to take off her bra. She wants me to take off her bra. Just as I unclasp it, she moves her hand under my tie and unbuttons my shirt and moves her hand inside. Then she feels a second set of buttons. She stops. "Are you wearing two shirts?" "My pajamas." It never occurred to me that any of my clothes might be coming off tonight. What choice do I have? I take off my tie, unbutton my shirt, and hold it open like Superman, revealing to her the red and white striped pajama top. She bursts out laughing, second time tonight, but it doesn't bother me at all. I explain about the scratchy suit and the stiff shirt and how uncomfortable it was on my skin. "That's okay," she says. "I just didn't know I was going to have to do two shirts." And I watch as she unbuttons my pajamas. Why did I think there would be a fight? Why had I assumed I would be the only one who wanted something, and that getting it would be as impossible as stealing a comb from the hand of a mermaid? In all my imaginings, all I could ever think of was what I would do. I never considered the most obvious point. If you're doing it, you're doing it with another person. They're going to be a part of it too. Is it possible they could ever feel desire as intensely as I do? The only time the other person came into focus in my fantasies is when they got angry and harshly told me to stop it. Now we're kissing again, and more. You want her. She wants you. You both want the same things. This is magic. This is a miracle. She actually likes you. Remember how that feels? I do. We don't do everything, but everything we do is way more than we've ever done with anyone else. And we do it for 2 hours. 2 hours. Then we stop. We're done. We've done enough for one night. We both sit back. The spell is lifting, but it's not quite broken. We were both just there. And whatever happened, the only people who know anything about it is us. What happened is ours. But that's enough. For tonight, it's enough. This date has lasted 8 hours. And I'd say we definitely ended up in San Francisco. It's past 1 a.m. Her mom said her curfew was midnight, but we're parked right in front of her house and no one has come outside or even turned on a porch light, so I guess we're okay. I walk her to her door, breathing in the cold night air like I'm swimming up from deep waters. I can smell juniper and orange blossoms. A final goodnight kiss seems almost quaint now, but we do it anyway, and then she goes inside. I stand there for a minute, and then I walk back to my car, alone now in this new life of mine, trying to process who I am now. Something huge has happened. It's so huge even I can't put it into words. Well, maybe one word. Finally. When I get home, I barely look at the tape recorder. Anything that cassette has to say seems very unimportant right now. This world has just become very interesting to me. The next world will have to wait. Right beside the recorder, centered on my desk, is the yellow legal pad that contains the entire handwritten outline for my A-Team episode. Tomorrow, I will begin writing script pages. It occurs to me that if I can spend the rest of my life dividing my time between writing all day and kissing girls all night, I will have exceeded any dream of happiness that I could ever imagine. I get into bed, turn my radio on to 106.7 K-Rock, and let the music and the voices carry me to sleep. When I wake up the next morning, my face hurts. Everything from my chin to my nose feels rubbed raw. Did we make out that much? That hard? I sneak into the bathroom. My face looks normal, but damn, I guess we got pretty into it. We better take it easy next time. Next time. I decide to wait until the afternoon before calling her. I want to check in and, you know, make sure everything's cool and she doesn't regret anything that happened. Around 3, I call her. And we talk. And she feels the same way I feel, sore mouth included. Something happened between us and we're both pretty thrilled with ourselves. So should we do it again next Friday? Yeah, let's do it. So we have our second date. We see Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. And it makes us both feel weird. Not sexy at all. Unsettled. And it doesn't help that we saw it at the Beverly Center, which is like seeing a movie in a haunted space station. We drive back from West Hollywood to Alhambra and park in front of her house again, but I feel like whatever magic we'd found last week is lost to us now. But I'm wrong. It turns out it doesn't matter how weird the movie was. We still like each other, and we still want to try out the stuff we'd gotten started on a week earlier. So we do. And it's even better. How is this possible? It's like we've discovered a new element in the universe that, as you consume it, somehow increases. By our third date, Michelle and I were clearly boyfriend and girlfriend, and we let our friends know, as if they didn't already. My life is finally good. The pain and the fear and the worry is leaching out of me. And I am so proud that she is my girlfriend. She's smart. She's nice. She's been accepted to UC Berkeley. She knows what a calculus is, or she knows how to use a calculus. I don't know. And we still have the prom coming up. But I'm already thinking past that. I'm still a junior, but she's a senior. She's going to be graduating pretty soon. Maybe next year I could drive up and visit her at college. We could spend weekends in San Francisco. How hot would that be? By then, I'd be a professional TV writer. Everyone would be impressed with Michelle's boyfriend from LA who wrote for the A-Team. We were going to be a power couple. Then something happened that at first seemed great. Michelle got accepted to Yale. It was her reach school, and she only applied because her grades were so good that the college counselors insisted. She was perfectly happy to go to Berkeley, but now Yale had said yes. How do you say no to Yale? You don't. It was more than her family could afford, more than most families could afford, but her mom assured her if she wanted to go, they'd find a way. There were grants and scholarships and loans to apply for. Maybe they'd have to cut some corners, not that there were a lot of corners not already being cut, but still, you don't say no to Yale. So she said yes. And with that yes, clouds began to appear in my blue sky. Barely noticeable at first. On a subconscious level, Yale scared me. Scared me in a way Berkeley didn't. I'd been to Northern California, but I'd never been further east than Las Vegas. I wouldn't be able to go see her whenever I wanted to. There would be a lot of guys at Yale. Smart guys. Rich guys. Good-looking guys that probably didn't give a shit about the A-Team. This could be a problem. But what the hell, I thought. That's 4 months from now. A lot can happen in 4 months. The final three chapters of Susie Smith's book review the evidence of EVP and examine it from all sides. It's the same arguments you'll hear today, almost 50 years later. On the skeptical side, the most common argument is auditory pareidolia, which is the perception of vocal patterns in random noises where none exist. This is undoubtedly a real phenomenon and absolutely accounts for many mistaken examples of EVP. Another complaint is that some of the voices are stray radio signals. A popular method of recording back then involved tuning a radio to the white noise between stations and hoping to pick up voices there. I guess I always assumed the idea was that the dead were able to speak to us by accessing certain radio frequencies that weren't otherwise being used. But as it turns out, the actual theory is that the spirit voices need some sort of sound bed against which to imprint their voices. And you can use pretty much anything. The sound of running water, phone apps like EVP Maker, or, in the original case of Jurgensen, nothing more than bird calls. There is another common argument, but it's more about the origin of the voices. You see, even within parapsychology, there are researchers who we call anti-survivalist. They're willing to consider paranormal phenomena, poltergeists, precognition, psychokinesis, and even the appearance of ghosts. But they don't feel that any of this proves or is necessitated by the survival of the human personality beyond death. They feel it's all generated through the power of living agents. In other words, the voices are coming from us. Somehow the researchers themselves are unconsciously imprinting the voices on tape. No dead people involved. To this I say, hey, that's still pretty fucking amazing. Look, the real question is this: why are any voices ever showing up at all? Personally, I'm not going to stand around arguing about what the voices are saying or who is speaking. For me, it just boils down to, why are there any voices at all? For me, there is no doubt that electronic voice phenomenon is a real thing. But of course, I do find it frustrating 50 years on that we are no closer to an explanation about what's happening and why. Smith's book ends on an incredibly upbeat note of excitement, enthusiasm, and optimism. After all, it was 1977, and EVP felt like the parapsychological puzzle piece we'd all been waiting for. Researchers around the world were piling up evidence every day, faster than it could be examined or cataloged. All our questions were finally being answered. Susie Smith's final words are these. Quote, "Whatever it is that's going on, it is something exciting and challenging. And if someday it should be possible to prove that these are actually the voices of the dead, then I can only say hallelujah." One night, the week before prom, I finally listened to the tape I made on the night of our very first date. Near the end, I thought I heard a single word, but I couldn't be sure. The word sounded like help. But I didn't care. That revving motor I had felt inside my body all year finally had a purpose and direction. I was 16 and a half. I was a television writer, and I was in love. I could feel momentum building. Nothing was going to stop me now. As we dated more and the school year ended, and we dove into that long, hot summer and into each other more and more, the end of August loomed larger and larger, the day she would leave me and fly to the other side of the country. I was heading straight for it fast, like a car speeding toward a brick wall. And no matter what I did, there was no way to keep from crashing, and no way I was going to slow down. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me again next time as we move into the summer of 1983 with Phone Calls from the Dead. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Rocketmoney.com/cancel.